As I mentioned a couple of Sundays ago, I recently got to spend some time with an old friend who, as well as being a minister in the United Church of Canada, is also a chaplain in the armed forces. I have some real interest in his work, and so at one point my friend Foster and I asked him if he'd tell us a bit about his time serving in Afghanistan. It was sobering to hear. One quite minor, but I found rather illuminating thing I discovered about listening to him was his occasional use of military terms. Usage that required us to say that again? And that's because it was a form of jargon that we just weren't familiar with. And so as it turns out, a FOB isn't simply a watch chain or a vest pocket, it's a forward operating base. Things you learn on the way, eh? In other words, the military is like any other profession or field of study. It could be trades or businesses or academia or hobbyists. Certainly my years of work in the hospital were filled with jargon. Terms that are understood well within the field and they get developed and they get used to make communication actually easier, but within the field. But outside that area of interest, well, not necessarily so. And we are especially good at it in the church. Both in the larger sense of church and denominationally and sometimes even congregationally. It's possible to arrive at a new church or join a new denomination and discover that it's like they're speaking a whole new language. And to be clear, the intent of this is usually quite good. Sometimes it's helpful, and other times it can be confusing and even alienating. Now, the intent is, as we say, is good, but ironically, it may actually get in the way of our prime task of communicating the good news of Jesus. For example, when I say, it's in the narthex, I'm sure someone is thinking, so where would I find one of these narthex things in the real world? Oh, we're a missional church. You're a what? Well, you know, that is a question of stewardship. Say again, stewardship? Yes, washed in the blood of the Lamb. Now that is an inviting phrase to a newcomer, isn't it? Can I get an amen on that? We can include that in our list too. Try saying that in the real world. And do note that none of these expressions are wrong or not useful. They are. But they are in-house terms. They're in-house phrases. And so we need to use them carefully if and when we do need to use them. It's rather like those other words, theology and confession and sin and sanctification and salvation and even ministry. These are fine and useful words. I love them. I love them because they're rich in meaning. But sometimes they can be a bit confusing or even loaded with less than helpful baggage to a good portion of the people that we're actually trying to communicate with, trying to connect with. I was thinking about this the other day when I read through a sermon a clergy colleague had asked me to have a look at. They had some uncertainty about the sermon, and they wanted me to give it a second opinion. It is one of the many services that I do provide. And in it, they spoke about bringing something to the foot of the cross, which can be, depending on the audience, a most powerful image and invitation. But I also know to some that expression might be a bit of a head-scratcher, because what does it mean to bring something to the foot of the cross? In our text today, on this day of the church year that we call Christ the King Sunday, a day when we ponder Christ's sovereignty, I think we're being asked, what do we mean when we say Jesus is King? What do we mean by that? This morning's Bible reading is just a small portion of St. John's account of that last day of Jesus' life. I admit that that whole section from chapters 13 all the way through and including the end of chapter 19, this is a most difficult read in some ways. But we do need to read it because John, just as all the other Gospels do, John makes it the very centerpiece of his account. And nothing else in the Gospel actually makes sense without understanding this particular portion. The section we heard read this morning takes place after Jesus had been arrested and examined by the religious authorities who were looking for some way to get rid of this threat that he represented. And do know that Jesus was perceived as a threat to the religious establishment. And sometimes, perhaps even oftentimes, he still is. For he continues to upset the apple cart, continues to cleanse a most well-meaning temple, which is why we spend so much time focusing on him. Because we need to be open to that. We need to be open to the questions he asks of us. We pick up the story after he's been shuttled off to Pontius Pilate, the Roman governor, for interrogation. Pilate's already tried to avoid getting involved in what he probably first saw as an internal Jewish church problem. But the leaders, they were so insistent that he relents and he has him brought in. Okay, now a bit about Pilate. Pilate was the fifth prefect, the fifth person to serve as governor of Judea. He did so for about 10 years. He did so from 26 AD to 35 AD. Pilate was a member of Rome's lower nobility, and he was directly under the authority of and directly reporting to the emperor himself. Palestine, well, it wasn't exactly a plum posting in some ways because Judea was demanding. It was a really fractious place. Troops were required to be stationed there. But then it was also a significant posting in the sense that it was a geographically significant piece of real estate. It was on an important trade route. And the Roman Empire is very much like our society. At the end, it's about the money. While we know nothing of his history prior to going to Judea, it's reasonable to assume that Pilate being sent there indicates that he must have had some success as an administrator elsewhere because it was an important place. You needed an experienced hand to look after things. However, we also know that his track record in Judea wasn't especially impressive. He was not known for his sensitivity or compassion. He was not known for his insight into things Jewish. Should note that his base of operations wasn't Jerusalem. It was Caesarea up on the coast. That was his primary residence because that was the administrative center of Rome in the region. Of course, Pilate was required to occasionally visit Jerusalem. Other historical records indicate that the first time he did so, it was a complete disaster. When he arrived, like all the other prefects before him, he arrived with an armed escort. He would be an idiot not to travel with guards in such a quarrelsome place. But unlike his wiser predecessors, he refused to have his troops remove the image of the emperor from their standards, from the flags or the banners that they carried. Remember that the emperor was officially considered a god to the Romans. Though it's important to note that not all the emperors actually believed that themselves. But to the Jewish faithful, it meant that a version of graven images were now being imported into their holy city. And so for them, the second commandment was being broken. And so, well, there was an uproar. When Pilate went back to Caesarea, a contingent of the Jewish faithful followed, and they asked him to please respect their beliefs. To which he replied, "If you don't learn to live with it, I'll have you killed." And so they bared their necks to him right then and there, and they said, "I guess you'll need to start beheading us then." And so a rather shaken Pilate backed down. There was another occasion to pay for a much-needed aqueduct into Jerusalem. Pilate paid for it by taking a portion of the money that had been given to the temple. Oh, dear. That was not so good, and riots followed, and soldiers dressed in plain clothes circulated amongst the population, and they ended up stabbing and beating protesters to death. So there was more resentment by Pilate's lack of prudence here. And not learning from that first incident, he eventually moved to have the name of the Emperor Tiberius emblazoned on the shields of his troops who were stationed in Jerusalem, which was essentially the same problem as before. They now would have the name of a foreign god in their capital. And this time Pilate was determined he was not going to back down. So what happened was the Jewish leadership, they went directly to his boss. They went to the top. They appealed directly to the emperor, who in turn ordered Pilate to smarten up and take his name off the shields. So I tell you all this because it's important to understand that Pilate was just a little sensitive to religious disputes by this point. He had been badly burned by them before. Most importantly, he'd been embarrassed in the eyes of his boss, the Emperor Tiberius, because he mishandled and misunderstood religious sensibility of the Jews. And here he is, in our reading, once again, trapped in the middle of a religious dispute, and he just wants it to go away. But experience also told him that he couldn't have it just go away. So he's going to have to use some tact here. He was being asked to enter into a dispute that had, for his good fortune, one dimension that he knew something about. He knew about kingship. And he knew who was king. Pilate had no doubt that ultimately in Judea, the person in charge, the king, was Tiberius. Of course, you and me, We know something about royalty too, don't we? We have a queen. We know that she has a place in our governance. She plays a role in our lives, though at some distance. But you find her image on our money. We occasionally sing God Save the Queen here together. Our top official is her first servant, Prime Minister. And a good many of us have a real affection for her. I know I do. And you know that somewhere Gladys Killip is going, yes. But our queen is a constitutional monarch. We know that there are some pretty severe limits on her power. And further to that, the state's power, the state's control of our lives, there are limits to that. But things were much, much different in the ancient world. The king, the queen, the emperor, they would wield much greater power. And even in Rome, where some of that power had been given to the Senate, the emperor still had sweeping powers. A royal position would frequently be passed on by some sort of recognized succession from parent to child or to a brother or relative in that way. Some of you who may have caught that news story this week of a Langling man, his name is Eric Manu. He's an immigrant from the Ashanti region in Ghana. He just recently discovered that the death of his uncle means he's now a king. So he's gone. One week he was a landscaper in Langley, and now he is a king in Ghana. And that all happens because, well, it's contingent on family relationship. But that wasn't necessarily how power would exchange hands in the ancient world. Sometimes, of course, individuals would seize power militarily. Or, as happened to Herod the Great some three decades before the birth of Jesus, his position and power in Israel was gifted to him by an appreciative Roman government. And that was a reward for his victory over the Parthians. Kingship could simply be seized, and it wasn't necessarily a result of who your daddy happened to be. Which brings us to our meeting today between Pilate and Jesus, a meeting we note on this Christ the King Sunday. Pilate somehow been told that Jesus has some pretensions about being a king. And he might not know much about Judaism, but he knew lots about power and politics. And so he bluntly asks Jesus, he says, are you the king of the Jews? Now, don't for a minute think that Pilate is especially worried about him as a threat, as a danger. This Jesus poses no threat to him or to the emperor. Anyone can see that. I mean, he's got no army. He has no significant following. And the few followers he did have turned tail and run. But Pilate's got a job to do, and so he says, let's ask this clearly not a king if he thinks he is a king. And so he posed this question, are you the king of the Jews? And like countless of us have discovered over the years, asking Jesus a question can take a conversation to a rather unexpected place. Because we think we know what we're saying, we think we know our terminology, we think we know our jargon, as it were, but we discover that Jesus is using the same words in a much, much different way. And so we are often puzzled and surprised. Jesus responds to Pilate's question by asking a question of him. Jesus loves to clarify things by returning a favor and asking us questions. In this case, he says to Pilate, where'd you get that idea from? Pilate dismissively says, do I look like a Jew to you? Your own people, your own church brought you to me. You must have done something. So what'd you do? Then Jesus uses a term that Pilate certainly thinks he understands. He says the word kingdom. He says, my kingdom isn't this. It's not what you see around you, governor. It's different than this. If it was this, then my disciples would fight so that I wouldn't have been handed over to the priests, the people running the church. It's a kingdom that comes from a different authority. So I'm not that kind of king. I'm not the world's kind of king. But please note this also. While Jesus is clearly saying that his kingdom comes from another place, that it's not the same as Roman rule or British rule or American rule or Ottoman rule or Canadian rule, he is saying that his kingdom is for this world. This isn't simply and only a kingdom in the realm of heaven. It's also a kingdom here on earth today. And yes, Pilate, Jesus is claiming to be a king, claiming that this is exactly why he was born, to bring this truth, the truth. If we were to keep reading from where Wanda left off, we would see and hear a world-weary and rather cynical Pilate, the one who sees everything purely through the lens of politics and winning, of raw power, the power that's imposed through swords and guns and air power and shooting people in theaters or while they have dinner in a restaurant, or even having whipped the appropriate number of votes to be victorious over one's opposition, something that we have even more than occasionally been doing in our church to our great shame. We read that Pilate throws out this dismissive question, what is truth? And then he says to Jesus' accusers, I don't see any case against this Jesus of yours. It's interesting, isn't it? Pilate's missed it again. Just as he didn't understand what was going on in those previous failures in judging what was going on in Judea, he has failed to understand one more time. He missed out that Jesus was a king. Not just of the Jews, but of everything and of everyone. And so he was actually really a threat to the kings and the queens and the kingdoms of this world. Of course, the drama will continue to unfold beyond these verses, and eventually Pilate will relent and have Jesus taken to the cross, where he will willingly die for the sins of the whole world, even yours and mine, as terrible as they are. And that cross, that place of execution, became his throne. What John the Gospel writer would claim revealed his glory. That's what he called the cross. Jesus' glory. And so on this Christ the King Sunday, you and I are indeed invited to the foot of the cross. a fine, fine expression that reveals the glory and the paradox and the truth and the power that was revealed on a Friday afternoon that we refer to as good. A place where we pledge our fealty, our faithfulness, our obedience, our love to our King, enthroned on that cross. You know, I believe that we're still being questioned today. Christ himself is asking us a question. You see, Pilate was absolutely right in asking Jesus, "Are you a king?" He just didn't understand Jesus' answer. And so Jesus is asking us, "Am I the one? Am I your sovereign? Am I your king?" See, much hangs on that answer, on your answer. It has the potential to change everything. It might actually change the world. Amen.